Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hi and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me Neil Denny, and I'm welcoming back Richard Holloway to the show. Richard Holloway was formerly the Bishop of Edinburgh and Primus of the Scottish Episcopal Church. He is a Fellow of the Royal Society and a former Gresham Professor of Divinity. He has written for many newspapers in Britain, including The Times, The Guardian, The Observer and The Scotsman, and he has presented several series for BBC Television. Richard's books include Dancing on the Edge, Godless Morality, and Between the Monster and the Saint. His most recent is Leaving Alexandria, a memoir of faith and doubt. So I've been joined by Richard Holloway. Richard, thanks for coming and speaking to Little Atoms again.
You're very welcome.
So we're talking today about Leaving Alexandria, your latest book, which is a memoir. Since you retired as the Bishop of Edinburgh, you've written numerous books, and this is the first one that's really a memoir. So why a memoir at this point?
Well, it's actually quite a funny little story. When I was a boy of 14, I left Alexandria in the west of Scotland and went to an Anglican religious order, a monastery on the banks of the Trent in England, to train to be a priest. And the order left Kelham Hall in 1973, and they kept the graveyard. So Kelham Hall is now a government offices for Newark and Sherwood District Council. And I've been going back and standing in the graveyard every two or three years and looking at the graves of the old fathers who taught. And in July 2009, I made a particular visit. And while I was there, my American daughter phoned me. It was her birthday. And in telling her where I was, I burst into tears. And I wrote that day up, and I realized that I was trying to compare what I was like as an ardent 14-year-old, zealous little Christian boy trying to give his life away to God with the particular journey I'd had when I'd kind of fallen out of sorts with the church and had actually left the ministry in 2000. And so I wrote this book to try and discover how all that had come about. It's a memoir, which is not an autobiography. A memoir is a kind of a journey in search of the self. And I wanted to find out what it was about me that maybe helped make those things happen. And it was quite an enlightening journey. I did discover things about myself I hadn't quite realized. I called it Leaving Alexandria because I'm from Alexandria, but also because Alexandria becomes a kind of symbol of the fact that I was a more nomadic person than I realized. Rather than being a settler in one institution, I've been someone who's tried different roles, different approaches, different ideas.
Well, yeah, you describe yourself as a habitual leaver in the book, and that, you know, there is an obvious point there in the title, and as you said, of leaving your hometown, but that becomes something of a sort of central image throughout the book, and we'll sort of get to that later. But I just want to look at that ardent 14-year-old boy for a moment. And you describe coming from a background in which, you know, obviously it was a time where mainstream Christianity was obviously the norm, but you describe your parents as pretty much irreligious. So where do you think the ardour came from in the 14-year-old? I mean, especially as, although on the one hand, you know, you're going off to a seminary to train to be a priest, but it is much more than that, because as you described, you go into what is basically a monastic order. You are going to basically devote your life, as you see it at the time, to becoming ostensibly a monk.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it came about like this. My wee cousin died of spinal meningitis, and my mother went to comfort the mother of the child who died, and she said to me, when you come home for lunch, don't come home, visit your cousin Mary's, because I'll be there. And while I was there, the rector of St. Mungo's Alexandria, the little Episcopal church in the edge of town, came to arrange the funeral. And before he left, he asked my mother who I was, and she said, that's my boy Dick. And he said, Dick, can you sing? And she said, yeah, he's got a good voice. And he asked me if I'd like to join the choir. And I was kind of intrigued, a little bit intimidated by this austere-looking man, and I said yes. And I turned up at church that Sunday, and I fell in love with it. He turned this little church in the edge of an industrial town into a kind of an Anglo-Catholic shrine. And I was a romantic little boy. I'd spent a lot of time on the hills, and the hills provoked in me a strange kind of restlessness to try and find something, as it were. And in St. Mungo's Alexandria, which he turned into this kind of romantic Catholic shrine, I felt a sense of the same thing, that there was something beyond it that I couldn't quite reach, but I was provoked by it. And so I became very attached to it. And he used to talk about the greatest call a man could have would be to give his life away to God in the priesthood, to sacrifice everything. And it kind of fitted my romantic temperament, the fact that I loved cowboy pictures where the lonely hero sorted out a bad town and drifted off into the prairie. And I went to him when I was about 13 and said, I'd like to be a priest. And he said, I think that's a good idea. I think you're called to it. And he then arranged for me to go to this monastery in England that trained poor boys like me for the priesthood. And I fell in love with that. It was a kindly place, very austere. We worked very hard. It was very, very disciplined. Cold showers every morning, all of that kind of stuff. But I just was caught by it and wanted to give my life away then as a monk, as a religious. And that was the wee boy of 14 that the book starts with.
I was particularly taken by those two things. First of all, the young boy going off on his own and wandering in fields and hills. And the other thing was being his obsession with the movies, because both of those remind me of my own self as a child. And it is interesting, how those exact same needs develop in a different way. Mm-hmm. In terms of the talking about wandering the hills with a sort of realisation that there was something out there, you describe it in the book as a latency, which is a really powerful image. You're talking about something that's sort of hidden, something that's beyond reach.
And I think that's what fascinates the human, because we are extraordinary creatures. We're animals plus. We have these big brains. We have this reflective self-consciousness. Some of us can't not ask questions about whether the universe means anything, how it came to be, whether there is something behind it. And you frequently get a sense of latency or liminality, something just beyond, disappearing just around the corner ahead of you. And I think that at heart is part of the religious quest as well. It's also part of the artistic quest. And I think that both my hill walking and my movie going amplified what was probably an innate tendency in me anyway. And this order, the Society of the Sacred Mission, they built a wonderful chapel behind the old Victorian Hall. And it was a very numinous place, very lofty, sense of transcendence. And again, it filled you with the same kind of ache to find out if there was something beyond it, something elsewhere. And all of that was kind of charging around inside my heart and my head. I didn't know who I was, of course, at that stage. It was even before puberty when all this happened, a very suggestible time. And then, of course, puberty hit, and that had its own tumultuous impact upon me.
You describe in the book very vividly, a thing that happens to every single human being that's ever lived, basically, which is confused adolescent sexuality. And that's really the thing that undoes your commitment to the life at Kelham. But at the same time, that phrase, sort of confused adolescent sexuality, seems to sum up for me quite a lot about the church, really, and that seems to be the point at which the church is stuck at when it comes to any sort of discussion of sexuality. And I think later on in the interview we can perhaps look at that on a more general level. But like, particularly, you describe very vividly how this basically brought the end to your dreams of the standard model of the lifelong celibate priest.
Yeah, dear old Christianity doesn't help us. I mean,
no.
Sexuality is quite a difficult thing to cope with anyway, because we have these urges, we can't let them rip, we're not animals. If we do, we can hurt people. Nevertheless, they can delight us, they can bond us, they can give us enormous pleasure. And for some reason, Christianity associated them with a particular intensity of evil. Indeed, St. Augustine taught that sexual intercourse was almost the way in which sin was passed on to sinful humanity, original sin, original guilt. And so they freighted this weakness, and it can be a weakness, but they freighted this weakness with an almost unique kind of burden of guilt. And I felt that as a little boy when I had my first climax. And you almost immediately, I suppose there's always a sense, of which nature might make you feel that. But I knew, even without being tutored, that I'd fallen somehow. And I took this new sexually aware creature who couldn't talk about it, that didn't get talked about. The fathers tried to teach me the facts of life, but they didn't actually give me any advice on how to handle this. And here I was trying to give myself an absolute purity to God, and all the time I was plagued with these imaginings, and I would go to confession and try and unload them, and it never went away. And I look back on all that now, all that misery. It wasn't undiluted misery, but it was a preoccupation. I just wish someone had said to me, everyone does it, it's natural, just, you know, be careful, don't let it take complete hold of you. I think Christianity is a bit better about it now than it was in my day. We're talking 50, 60 years ago. But it still is hung up on sex. And, of course, we've got the whole big debate at the moment about gay sex, about whether gay people can be ordained, whether they can be married in church. We're still not through it. It's astonishing.
That's something I want to come back to later in the interview. That's sort of what I meant when I said this would come up again. There's a fantastic quote from, if I seem to remember correctly, it's the head priest at Kelham who says it, which is this idea that the only thing that matters is lives.
Yeah, only whole lifetimes count.
Only whole lifetimes, which means basically devoting, becoming a celibate priest and devoting your whole life until the day you die to, you know, to the service of God. And you described yourself as a romantic earlier. This is certainly the sort of romantic image of the priest. It also seems to me, as someone on the outside, as almost the most wrong thing with Christianity, this idea that, you know, we've just raised the idea of now the discussion is going on about gay marriage, and it seems like the least qualified people to be debating about natural or unnatural sexuality is someone who is perfectly breedable men who have devoted their lives to being celibate.
And probably not very comfortably either.
No, sure.
I think that there are celibates that somehow manage it. It may be that they've managed to sublimate it. I think it probably shows itself in some other way. Sometimes it shows itself in a kind of cruelty, sometimes in a kind of repression of the self that has to come out somewhere. To be fair to the people at Kelham, there was a kindliness there. I think that these were men who were quite humane. I mean, it showed itself nevertheless. And the founder of the order did have this high ideal that he wanted men who'd given themselves for life to something. And I didn't put it off, so I felt kind of haunted with the guilt, felt I'd disappointed myself and others. Looking back, I can see that a lot of it was a kind of romantic dream, and that as I was constituted, I was never going to be able to pull that off. But there are equally valid ways of having a committed and useful life. But nevertheless, that was sown in me as a wee boy, and it kind of lingered. And I suppose it's only in recent years that I've begun to understand myself, the springs of my own conduct. We live our lives forward, but we understand them backward. And looking back, I now can see that I wasn't cut out for that kind of life. But it gave me a great deal, and I have to be grateful for it. I wouldn't have received an education. I wouldn't have grown, I think, as a human being if I hadn't, however mysteriously, been diverted through that particular experience.
You say that you weren't cut out for that sort of life. I mean, is anybody?
I think there are some austere people, and I think that it depends on the motivation. I think there can be a great deal of guilt behind the spiritual life, this idea that you're disappointing God or you're saving your soul. I think that I've known some heroic people who, not out of a kind of negative trying to sacrifice themselves, but simply because they were compelled to help others to an almost heroic degree. I worked with people like that, and I think that's a better motivation. And you do get great examples. You get it in the artistic life as well. You get great writers, great artists, who are so dominated by their art that they sacrifice almost everything to it. And they can enrich the world as a result of what they've achieved, although maybe their own life is kind of dominated almost ferociously by a single idea. I'm thinking of someone like Lucian Freud, who he painted like mad. And you get great writers who do the same thing. Just think of Dickens. They were far from perfect people, but my goodness, what they achieved by that kind of almost celibate, there were neither of them celibate, but, you know, that purity of heart, that singularity of purpose, that can produce an enormous impact on the world.
It is, of course, particularly the sort of sacrifice of celibacy that I'm talking about. And in terms of, let's go on now to look at, you know, people that commit themselves through their religious belief or whatever to works of good. Because once you leave Kelham, you go away to Africa for a while, you come back and you're married, and the book finds you working in Glasgow, in the Gorbals, mm-hmm. in the role of, as you describe yourself, a sort of social worker stroke priest. Mm-hmm. And there is a debate about this idea of doing religion rather than speaking religion. Yeah. So first of all, let's tell me briefly what that means, and then we can sort of talk about that, you know, that sort of time when you were doing that.
The great figure behind that expression was Albert Schweitzer, mm-hmm. A great theologian who wrestled with the meaning of Jesus, trying to understand, to get into that mind. And he kind of ended up believing that Jesus had been an apocalyptic prophet who thought that by sacrificing himself, he would bring in the kingdom of heaven on earth, and he didn't. Nevertheless, he was haunted by Jesus. And so he gave up theology and trained to be a doctor and went off and spent the rest of his life working in the Congo. And as he was still haunted by the absolute call of Jesus, you know, to take up your cross and follow me, to serve the poor. He that saves his life will lose it. He that loses it will save it. And so he said in his journals that he wanted to give up talking about Jesus and simply follow Jesus. And there are a lot of people who reach a stage in life when they're so bored or fed up with religious discourse, because it seems to be a discourse that's permanently in disagreement. There can be no accident about the fact that there are more arguments about religion than almost any other topic, except maybe politics on earth, probably because each of them are so uncertain, that they're so imperfect. And it's very easy. I mean, E.M. Forster talked about poor little talkative Christianity. And there are people that just are bored with the talk, can never resolve the talk, but they're haunted by this absolute demand that they see in Jesus to be of service to other people. And when I was working in Gorbals, that in a sense was our ethic. We weren't very successful at getting the poor into church. In a sense, it didn't matter. They looked on us as people there to help and to serve, and we did a lot of that. There was a lot of laughter amidst the tears. And there was one woman in particular I worked with, a woman called Lilias Graham, who just gave her life away completely to this, but not in a way that made her dour and agonized and grim and plodding. She was a light person. You know, there was a kind of gaiety about her. She loved nice things. She was a toff. She came from the Montrose family. And yet she just had this lightness of being, and everyone in Gorbals adored her. The newspapers called her the Angel of Gorbals, because she just dedicated her life to that kind of a work in a way that lifted the heart and filled you with joy. And I compared her to me, because I was a much more self-conscious, self-aware person, watching myself being this heroic priest, knowing to some extent I was playing a role, whereas she seemed to be just unaware of herself, just getting on with doing it, not talking about goodness or love, just doing it, practicing it.
You described that self-consciousness again and again. You described playing a part, almost as if you don't feel yourself to be fully committed, in the same way that you're always reflecting yourself badly against sort of other characters in the book. But you demonstrate again and again that you're committed. You are committed for a number of years to the life at Kelham. You're committed for a number of years to the life in the Gorbals. So do you think that Lilas was also going through that same self-reflection, but in a sort of...
No, I don't think so. I mean, people do vary. I mean, there are some people, I think, who are just unself-consciously unaware of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the two people in the New Testament that characterize the difference, St. John, the beloved disciple, who is so self-effacing, you hardly get a sense of him. And then there's St. Peter, the braggart, full of impulsive gestures. He will follow Jesus to death and all of that. And he's the one that runs away, that deserts him. But he keeps coming back. I mean, and it's almost as though there are two different kinds of religious person. William James talked about the once born and the twice born.
Yes.
And I guess I belong to the twice-born or the many-born, a bit like Peter, constantly kind of aware of myself trying and failing, but never quite failing out. And also, I think, being a romantic child, spending a lot of time in the movies, I got used to watching and watching myself. So I was kind of conscious of the roles I was in. It didn't mean that I was insincerely following them, but there was a sense in which I was kind of watching myself filling a role, and that can be a real devil, a wee man standing on your shoulder watching you doing this. You can still be trying to do the good thing, but you're aware you're doing it, and that's my temperament. Whereas Lilius, I don't think, was aware. I mean, she was human, so she had her flaws that weren't as strident as mine. I suspect that she just kind of got on with it. I quote in the book a poem by Hugh McDermott about how there are some people that just have a capacity for mere being. I've known one or two people like that. They could sit beside the sick for hours and hours and hours simply being there, whereas a restless, easily bored person like me would try to do it, but all the time the meter would be whirring inside my mind, wondering when I could honourably get away to the next thing.
Do you not think, though, that what you're describing there is a healthy scepticism, a doubt that's a good thing? Because, you know, we were talking about a woman that was unselfconsciously committed to doing good. We could easily be talking about someone who was selflessly committed to doing bad things. Is that sort of nagging doubt not a healthy little devil on your shoulder?
Well, I don't think it's unhealthy. I mean, it was a fact. I mean, I think that self-consciousness can be a problem for certain people, and we've all known people who are so aware of being watched or wanting to be watched that in a sense there's the kind of lack of unself-consciousness about them. I doubt if you can actually make, unless there are some, I suppose Macbeth made evil his sanctity in a funny kind of a way. I think I do believe that there are good people. And there are bad people, and I think most of us are kind of caught in the middle. I wrote a book about this called Between the Monster and the Saint.
Mm-hmm, which we talked about on the last interview.
Yeah, we talked about that the last time. And I think that I'm kind of one of those people capable of good, capable of not so good, but not like Lilius, who I think just was a naturally good person, almost gifted by nature in a way. Yeah, I think a little bit of scepticism, a little bit of doubt. There's a lot of doubt in my makeup. I think these are all quite good. They can sanitize and disinfect sickly piety.
You're listening to Little Atoms this week with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Richard Holloway about his book Leaving Alexandria. At this point in the interview, Richard's batteries on his phone ran out, so you'll notice when we go into the next half that the sound changes a little.
One of the other major themes of the book, in terms of talking about the way in which the church has, in some respects, got it wrong, you describe it as the failure of the church to understand the nature of myth. And let's talk about what you mean by that exactly.
I think that the main discourse form of religion is myth. Meaning is carried through story. I mean, great examples are the parables of Jesus, the Good Samaritan, the prodigal son. You get the same thing in classic mythology, Ovid's Metamorphoses, the way in which they challenge our selfish thinking. They make us consider the complexities of living. And the Greek word for that is mythos. Then you've got another kind of discourse that's hard fact, the science of life, the biology of life, the physiology of life, the history of events. The Greeks would have called that logos, from our word, for studying things comes from that. And facts tend to be more datable than the narratives of myth because, I mean, for instance, ancient Greek science is not anything we would read nowadays because it's redundant. And the interesting thing about narrative is that great narratives carry enduring meaning. And I think that one of the mistakes that not all people who read sacred scriptures make, but it's a big mistake they make, they try to historicize myth. I mean, the most egregious example is to take the Adam and Eve story, which we know is a myth. We know now, since Darwin and even before that, that there was no single original couple, that we were not perfectly formed from the dust of the earth, that we evolved over millions of years and that we've only been in our current form for, I don't know, but half a million years, and it gradually evolving into something like Homo sapiens. That was an unimaginably long process. The story of Adam and Eve is not about a primordial event. It's about today in London, in Edinburgh. It's about the way couples get discontented with each other, with their status in life. It's a myth. Doesn't mean to say it's untrue. It means it is true in a non-factual sense. And I think that if you can grasp the distinction between that, you can liberate a lot of religious meaning. But what happens, and Nietzsche pointed this out, what kills religion is when they try to historicize their myth, when they try to make it into a provable scientific historical event, and then they start making great truth claims for themselves. And that, I think, is when they get into enormous trouble, because these truth claims are endlessly disputed. They start persecuting people because they don't accept the truth. And so you get the history of religion, which is riven with dissent, with cruelty, with punishment, with excommunication, with inquisition, and all of that. And I think it's a simple category mistake.
But this very syllogism, this very sort of literal biblical literalism, which we see nowadays, evangelical American Christianity, for instance, is quite a new thing. It's not, I mean, there always has been people who were more devout believers, but this is something that's quite a new thing, which is interesting. What do you think is the appeal of that now, at this point in history?
Well, it is. It's almost an American invention. I mean, I think the very word fundamentalism came from an evangelical movement in the States when people were returning to fundamentals. I think it's actually a kind of a very late development, and it's an attempt to try and scientize it, and attempt to try and turn religion into science, into hard facts.
So it comes out of the face of science, once the rise of Darwin and the rise of science, and it's the religious attempting to sort of reclaim some of that ground.
And on the basis of a complete misunderstanding of the nature of what religion is. I think religion is more akin to an art than to a science, which is why it can endure and why it does endure. It constantly reinterprets itself. And this idea that you took the Bible literally is very, very recent indeed. You don't get it in a scholar like Origen in the 3rd century. There have been any number of different ways of using these narratives. If you go to a Seder, a Jewish Passover, they'll be reading the great text of the Exodus, the text of the plagues, but they won't be taking that literally. They'll be taking it as a way of interrogating and passing on values. It's a kind of a folk ritual, a community act. And I think that it's Christianity in particular that has gone down this line in the last 70 years. And, of course, the States is the epicenter of it, which is why you've got these extraordinary culture wars going on over there. I mean, unbelievably bitter. And, they're dominating the American Republican Party's presidential primaries.
And to a massively detrimental degree, it would seem.
Yeah.
So you describe Christianity as a great work of human imagination, then.
I do, but I think it carries enduring values. This is the way I can use it. I'm well over trying to impose my eccentric views on other people. The one thing that I want to avoid myself, and I hope religion can avoid, is being cruel to other people. And I think that one of the problems with scientizing religion, with believing, for instance, not only that its myths are historical facts, but that it's a lot of the kind of social and cultural norms it inherited from the Bronze Age are still valid today. So you've got the idea of subordinating women, of persecuting gay people. I mean, secular society is well over that stuff, but poor old religion is locked into it because it somehow feels that its scriptures have to be permanently valid. Well, I think you just have to make sensible selections. And there clearly are enduring values, mercy, forgiveness, compassion, using imagination, all of those things. But what you don't continue are the Bronze Age values that were around at the time those great ideas came to the prophets. We no longer believe in slavery, but it took us 1,800 years to get rid of it. It took 2,000 years to emancipate women. God knows how long it's going to take us to emancipate gays. You'd think we'd learn.
There is an obvious question here when we're talking about the idea of Christianity being a great work of human imagination. And that is, of course, what part God, the idea of God, actually plays in that.
Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, the $68,000 question. There's no doubt that we've clearly made up God to a very great extent, and the history of God, Karen Armstrong wrote a book called that, and the history of God is a history of constantly refining the idea. God encouraged child sacrifice. No, he didn't. That was our ugly imagination. God encouraged slavery. No, we got God wrong there. And I think that the history of the God idea is one of gradual purification so that you're left almost with emptiness and silence. The thing that keeps me from atheism, and I don't know how to talk about God, which is why I prefer to be silent to talk about the absence of God. The thing that I think is enduringly mysterious is the fact of there being anything at all. And I don't think the world can explain itself. You'd have to get outside to a view from nowhere, and there's no way of doing that. A good parallel is if I think we, the mystery of mind, the mystery of consciousness, I think is one of those things that causes a very interesting dilemma. A neurologist could have wired us up as we were having this conversation and could have shown through graphs and neural waves and firing synapses the biology and the neurology of it. And he would have said that's what was going on. But you and I know that was going on, that was firing the brain, but we also have minds and personalities, and those measurements don't capture that any more than they can capture the uniqueness of a personality. So I think that science can explain much about us, but the mystery of our identity, it cannot explain. And I think that the same is true of the universe. I don't know whether this points to a God, but I agree with Wittgenstein that when every possible scientific question has been answered, the problem remains the very problem of existence. And we posited this little word God as a way of saying, is there something beyond it from which it came into being, or did it just pop into existence out of nothing? I don't know the answers to those things, which is why I'm in a state of unknowing and agnosticism, rather than certainly knowing there is a God or certainly knowing there isn't a God. I think the thing is unresolvable, but it certainly is mysterious.
I think that's, you know, that agnosticism is clearly a sensible position, and I don't mean from a sort of bet-hedging way, but, you know, the fact that, as you said, there's just no way of knowing what is actually outside of the universe. But there is, nonetheless, regardless of how we talk about it as a metaphor, you know, most people do identify the idea of God as being a sort of a being that acts upon the world. And if that, the sort of point I was trying to get to was, is that with, in terms of talking about myth and Christianity as being a great myth that we've sort of collectively decided to live our lives by, a human invention that we decided this is a good way of ordering society, this works out for us quite well in some respects, and so tradition carries it on. I suppose I'm going to sort of look back to Karen Armstrong here, because I'm sort of thinking, you know, why was it Jesus and not Socrates or something, for instance?
Well, I think it was both. I mean, I think that there are a number of remarkably protean figures: Buddha, Socrates, Jesus, Isaiah, all sorts of other people. I think these are gifted, inspired people who move us on a bit, challenge us morally, and I don't think you have to divinize them, although divinizing is one of the ways in which you give them a kind of an absolute authority over you. I think you can treat that as a metaphor rather than as an actual fact. And I think the great thing about religions is that they hand on the stories. I just wish they could do it a bit more graciously and a bit less forensically.
It's interesting, you mentioned slavery. You'll often hear it said the part that Christianity played in the ending of slavery.
Yeah,
it's often trumpeted, but I sort of often wonder if that is often mentioned because it's almost the last great thing it did. I mean, you've described how, you know, the emancipation of, you know, of women and gays have been secular achievements.
Yes.
Why has the church been left behind? Why was the church not part of the emancipation of women, for instance?
There would have been individuals who
but I
think as an institution, the church definitely was not in the vanguard. It was in the guardsman. I mean, it took up the rear here. And I think it's because it shackled itself to this kind of understanding that it couldn't just do the right thing because it was the right thing. It had to find a religious justification. And I instance the way we wrestled in the church with ordaining women, and most of the texts seem to forbid it, certainly tradition seemed to forbid it, and we desperately fell on a text in Galatians, in Christ there is neither male nor female, Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, and that, thank God, we can use that to justify the ordination of women, rather than simply saying, we got this wrong, we always do, we're always kind of shackled by the conventions of the time. If you look back on what people were doing 100 years ago, we say, how could they have justified that? We were shoving kids up chimneys 100 years ago in Victorian Edinburgh. We look back and we've had the Children's Factory Acts and all of that. And to some extent, Christianity did help a little bit with that. I think the difficulty here, the peculiar difficulty, is what we've been talking about, is sex. For some reason, anything to do with gender differences, with the liberation of women, and they've always been looked upon as rather suspicious agents of temptation to men, and certainly homosexuality. I think it's sex that somehow has just, Christianity's pathologized it and made it almost impossible to get over it, to move on. I just hope that we will one day learn, but my God, it doesn't look as if it's going to be any time soon when you consider the virulence of the debate on the gay marriage thing.
It does seem, again, from the outside, from the outsider's perspective, things like, you know, the church's attitude to gay people and its hostility to ordination of women priests, these things do seem astonishingly petty, tiny small things. Do you think there is any chance of them leaving this sort of pettiness behind?
I think in pockets. I mean, there are. It's always the small units that do it. The Quakers have left it behind. The Unitarians have left it behind. There are pockets of Anglicanism that have left it behind. But the bigger battalions, and of course, the bigger the religious unit is, the more entrenched its views seem to be. And the great Roman Catholic Church is probably the one that's going to change most slowly. I mean, it's a bit, I liken it to kind of ships and things. I mean, that's an enormous liner. It needs a big turning circle. The Quakers are a small rowing boat, and they can turn on a dime. But I think it's the small ones that act as kind of, they bring the future to the bigger ones. They experiment with these new approaches and things, and then the thing gradually catches on. But I wouldn't hold my breath, brother, about seeing this one resolved anytime soon.
Well, I've been talking to Richard Holloway about his book Leaving Alexandria, A Memoir of Faith and Doubt, which is out now from Canongate, and I highly recommend it. It's an absolutely wonderful read. Richard, thank you so much for talking to me about it.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed that.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.